Democrats engaged in a last-ditch effort to convince the American people that President Trump is a Russian agent. That hearing was the pitiful finale of a three-year-long operation by the Democrats, the corrupt media, and partisan bureaucrats to overturn the results of the 2016 election.
California Congressman Devin Nunes, back in 2019 at the start of then-President Trump's first impeachment hearing, one of Trump's staunchest allies, Nunes says he is leaving Congress at the end of this year to head Trump's new media company. The same day he announced his resignation, it was also revealed that regulators at the SEC are investigating the SPAC company behind Trump's new media venture. Nunes has represented California's San Joaquin Valley for nearly 20 years, and he was poised to take over the powerful House Ways and Means Committee if Republicans retake the House in next year's midterms. But it was unlikely that Nunes would have been reelected in those midterms. Because of redistricting, his seat will likely be in a new Democratic-leaning district. Here to talk about this is Jeremy White. He covers California politics for Politico. Welcome back.
Pleasure to be here.
Pleasure to have you. All right. So you cover California politics professionally, and so you've been keeping an eye on Devin Nunes and his colleagues, as well as the redistricting process. So was it a surprise when he announced yesterday that he would not seek re-election?
I would put it like this. I was surprised to hear that he was not going to seek re-election simply because, while, as you point out, the draft map of his district suggests that his current safely conservative district is about to get a lot more welcoming to Democrats, a lot of folks in the Central Valley felt that the congressman might simply move to a district that was a little more amenable to his political views. So in that sense, I was surprised. My surprise dissipated a lot when we learned where he was going, which was essentially helping to advance the agenda of his ally, former President Donald Trump.
Right. And he certainly was helpful when he was in the House and the Republicans were in charge. He ran interference for Donald Trump, right? I mean, when it came to investigating alleged ties to Russia.
There's no doubt that Congressman Nunes has been one of the most sort of stalwart, reliable allies of former President Trump. And so it is kind of a full circle moment in ways that, you know, he was a congressman who was decently well known, I think, before the Trump era, but he really gained a lot of notoriety on both ends of the political spectrum for his role as a major Trump loyalist during the Trump years. And so the fact that his congressional career is now ending because of an opportunity connected to Donald Trump, it does feel like sort of a completing a journey in ways. Mm.
Right. But there is a little bit of irony in the fact that he will be CEO of this new media company, Trump Media and Technology Group, which it is officially being called, while at the same time, he has had very highly publicized fights with the media, suing many media organizations, including Twitter.
That's right, including my former employer, McClatchy. A lot of media organizations who have been in sort of the legal crosshairs of Devin Nunes. I would say, though, that in a way, it makes sense because the through line of those legal tussles is that the congressman believes, as does former President Trump, that the mainstream media is corrupt and unreliable. And so the fact that they are now trying to launch essentially an alternative media ecosystem to counter a mainstream media that they so deeply distrust, I think is pretty consistent with their shared beliefs.
Mm-hmm. And what is the goal of this new media organization? Is it to operate on the same level as a Facebook or a Twitter?
I think it is essentially to function as a counterweight or an alternative. So yes, in that sense, it gives, you know, supporters of the former president, ideological fellow travelers, a source of information that sidesteps gatekeepers like Twitter and Facebook, which of course booted the former president and have earned a lot of his animosity. The former president made a statement yesterday about bringing Congressman Nunes on board, saying that he understands we must, quote, stop the liberal media and big tech from destroying the freedoms that make America great. America is ready for Truth Social and the end to censorship and political discrimination. So clearly, the former president is positioning this enterprise as a way to continue advancing his agenda, which, as always with Donald Trump, is positioned as sort of counter to a media that is framed as being dangerous or un-American.
And Devin Nunes is a relatively young man. By making this move, does he see the center of power as shifting outside Congress? I know he wouldn't have faced a possible reelection in a newly designed district, but he could have hopped into a neighboring district that would have been more amenable to him, a friendlier district, because there is also redistricting of a Democratic seat that is likely to turn more Republican. So, but does he see that as, well, yeah, perhaps I could have one reelection in a different district, but this is really where the power is?
With the caveat that I have not spoken to the congressman about his reasoning, I think it's probably a little bit of both. With these new maps coming out in a few weeks, I think every elected official in California is looking around at potential options. Where might I run? Could I potentially run in a different area? Who might my opponents be? Who might my constituents be? And so when you think about choosing between sort of that uncertainty in Congressman Nunes's case versus the certainty of a platform that does give you some public clout in the way this does, I think it is a choice between, yes, should he remain in the House, a powerful position probably if the Republicans flip the House as they're favored to do, but a lot of uncertainty about how he would remain in the House exactly versus a sure thing that is consistent with his political identity, which is sort of a proponent of Trumpism. I think this is the choice that in terms of which one has more or less power, I would think about it as more of sort of a guaranteed route to power or remaining with some power.
And meanwhile, what does this mean for his old district and the power politics of in California?
You know, as I said, with these new maps coming out, things are in so much flux right now. And so it's a pretty complicated picture there. A few state lawmakers have suggested they may run for the seat. Of course, there were already Democrats who were running against Devin Nunes before he announced he would resign. Complicating the picture, not to give your listeners a headache, but there are going to be two elections. There's going to be a special election to fill out the remainder of Congressman Nunes's term in his current seat. And then in November, there's going to be an election to elect a new Congress member who's going to represent a new seat, which will be some of the current seat, some of the current constituents, also new constituents. And so it's such a sort of complex, hazy picture right now. There's no doubt that there's some opportunity for some politicians with an open seat, of course. But what that opportunity looks like, who is best positioned to seize it, I think that is still something that we're waiting for the dust to settle.
All right. Lots of open questions. Jeremy White from Politico, thank you, as always, for answering a few of them.
Always happy to come on.
Coming up, Devin Nunes' California colleague Kevin McCarthy, as leader of the House Republicans, has really refused to rein in the more extreme members of his conference. And we'll talk about why next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Even by our modern standards of political discourse, which are pretty low, let's face it, what's been happening in Congress lately is Well, it's kind of alarming. Arizona Republican Congressman Paul Gosar tweeting a cartoon video depicting him murdering New York Democrat Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Colorado Republican Lauren Boebert's racist and Islamophobic comments about Minnesota Democrat Ilhan Omar, calling her part of the jihad squad and claiming she only felt safe in an elevator with her if Omar didn't have a backpack. And then, of course, there is Marjorie Taylor Greene, the congresswoman who promotes QAnon conspiracy theories. My next guest calls Congress a cesspool of threats and extremism and places the blame squarely at the feet of the House Republican leader, California's Kevin McCarthy. Jackie Combs is an opinion columnist at the LA Times. She's based in Washington and author of the book Dissent, The Radicalization of the Republican Party and Its Capture of the Court. Welcome to Press Play, Jackie.
Thanks a lot, Madeline. Good to be with you.
Well, you're placing all the blame at the feet of one man, Kevin McCarthy?
Well, this will sound like a typical journalist, but I think the headline went a little too far. I wouldn't say that Kevin McCarthy is solely to blame, but there's no question he is the quote-unquote leader of the House Republican Conference. So, you know, he holds some blame by virtue of his position, and if there ever was a time that a leader didn't lead, it's now, with Kevin McCarthy refusing to publicly call out such monstrous comments as some of his Republicans are saying. You know, it's just dangerous, the kind of rhetoric that's coming out of House Republicans' mouths these days. And we've seen deadly violence in the not-so-distant past. So I just, if I were him, I would be terrified that if these people weren't reined in, that some, whether a deranged person or just an extremist, would be moved to violence.
So he has the power to censure or do something that would tell these more extreme members of his party to calm down, cut it out, walk back these extremist remarks. What could he do? What should he be doing that he's not doing?
Well, in the case of Congressman Paul Gosar of Arizona earlier this year, and again with Lauren Boebert of Colorado, the Democrats who are the majority left it to the House Republicans first to discipline the members and only stepped in to take what amounted to partisan party line votes against them to censure Gosar and remove him from committees. And we're very likely to see something like that against Congresswoman Boebert. But he could have, Kevin McCarthy, could have, first of all, publicly spoken out against them and then had the Republican conference remove them from their committees. I frankly think that's far less than they deserve. I think they deserve expulsion from the House. I mean, I covered Congress of all time for 13 years back in the 80s and 90s, and then I covered White Houses, so I had one foot in covering Congress for the past 20 years, and I have never, until recent years, seen anything like this. And that doesn't mean things weren't partisan when I covered Congress, but threatening the life or saying things that could threaten the life of another member of Congress should be so beyond the pale that you forfeit your right to be a member of Congress. And I don't say that lightly, because the voters send the members there. And to act to remove a person from Congress is an extreme act. But extreme actions by these members calls for extreme response.
I was reading a transcript of Kevin McCarthy's speech on the House floor during the debate over former President Trump's second impeachment. This was less than a year ago. And he was calling for unity.
As leaders, our place in history depends on whether we call on our better angels and refocus our efforts to work directly for the American people. United, we can deliver peace, strength, and prosperity our country's desperately needs. Divided, we will fail. What we saw last week was not the American way. Neither is the continued rhetoric that Joe Biden is not the legitimate president. Let's be clear. Joe Biden will be sworn in as president of the United States in 1 week because he won the election. And the presidency in this Congress will face immediate challenges that must be addressed. I stand ready to assist in that effort with good faith, goodwill, and an open hand.
That was less than a year ago. What has happened in these intervening months?
Well, after January 6th, when Kevin McCarthy also said that Trump was to blame for the violence, he then subsequently went straight to Mar-a-Lago to basically get forgiveness. Because what, in the wake of the insurrection, when many Republicans thought, and you could tell by their reactions, that Trump had gone too far, that he would be condemned for this, that he would be sidelined completely. He had lost re-election, and now he had incited an insurrection. But once they saw that the base of the party remained strongly behind Trump, they, you know, non-leaders that they are, got behind him as well. And it pains me to say this. I mean, we've seen that this week we had the death of Robert Dole. I covered him for all of the years that he was minority or majority leader of the Senate Republicans. And he was every bit a partisan himself, but he did not put party over country. He came together, like Kevin McCarthy says, but Kevin McCarthy doesn't do, in unity at points where it was called for and for the better of the country. I've been doing this a long time. I've seen a lot of partisanship. It goes with the turf. But this, like I say, is beyond the pale.
But does he need Trump support? Because with all the redistricting that is happening with Republicans who are controlling state legislative maps, it seems like a shoo-in no matter what that the Republicans will take over next year.
Well, if I were a betting person, I would bet that Republicans are going to win control of the House. But they could win the majority. That doesn't mean he becomes the speaker. The entire House, including Democrats, votes on who gets to be a speaker. But as a practical matter, the majority party elects the speaker. So he needs the vote of every Republican. And if he doesn't have them, he's not speaker. And Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert, among others, have served notice that if McCarthy doesn't lead, quote unquote, in a way that is more aggressive and polices not them for the actions we've been talking about, but takes action against House Republicans who voted, for instance, for the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Then they said if he doesn't do these things, they'll consider not supporting him for speaker, and they'll talk to Trump about their unhappiness. And they are very much in cahoots with Trump. He supports Marjorie Taylor Greene. He has called her the future of the party. He supports Lauren Boebert. And Trump, I think, just with a word, if he was thumbs down on Kevin McCarthy, I think Kevin McCarthy might be doomed for the speaker's race.
Even though the Boeberts and the Marjorie Taylor Greens, they are a very small minority of the people in Congress right now. Of the Republicans in Congress. I mean, there is Liz Cheney on the other side and
right.
other more mainstream Republicans. Would they all decide to support someone more conservative than Kevin McCarthy?
No, and I don't know that there is anyone more conservative. It's just a matter of who they want to make speaker. And, you know, Liz Cheney and Adam Kinzinger of Illinois, they're more a minority of two within the among House Republicans. And there aren't, you know, the fact of the matter is there aren't very many moderate Republicans anymore. The fact is, you might think that Lauren Boebert and Marjorie Taylor Greene are a minority within the minority, and they are, but there are more of them than you would think, and there are going to be more of them after the next year's midterm elections. But I do think that Kevin McCarthy would likely be speaker only because of the lack of another candidate in the wings. But it could be Steve Scalise, you know, the one who's a deputy now. That, to me, seems like a real possibility.
Well, it's not going to be Devin Nunes, who just announced his retirement.
No.
So there is that. What can the Democrats do, if anything, about this?
They can do the same thing that they did against Congressman Gosar, which is to hold a vote of the House to censor her and to remove her from her committees. And, you know, that just takes a majority vote, and they have the majority. So if all Democrats or nearly all vote for this resolution, it passes, just as it did against Congressman Gosar. And I would guess that there would be some Republican votes in favor of that resolution as well. Not many, but just as there were 10 House Republicans who voted for impeachment after the insurrection, I think there would be some votes to censure Congresswoman Boebert. But when you think about it, who are the House Republicans whose names you know? They're Marjorie Taylor Greene, Lauren Boebert, Paul Gosar. These are the people who become the face of the party. And if, you know, I don't know how Kevin McCarthy lives with that fact, except that he needs their votes to become speaker.
Jackie Combs, LA Times opinion columnist based in Washington. Jackie, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, I'll speak with the director of the new Danish documentary, Flea. It's an animated movie of a conversation between the director and his friend, Amin, in an Afghan refugee.
This is a refugee story told from the inside of a friendship. And to me, you know, Amin, yes, he's a refugee, but he's so much more. And I'm hoping that I can give some nuance to the refugee story.
Jonas Poor Rasmussen is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Jonas Pua Rasmussen and Amin Nawabi met when they were teenagers. They were on a train to school in rural Denmark. This was in the early 1990s. Superficially, they didn't have a lot in common. Rasmussen is Danish. Nawabi was a refugee from Afghanistan. But they became lasting friends. And yet, over the decades, Rasmussen never knew the true story of his friend's past, how he came to Denmark. Well, now he does. Nawabi has told his story to Rasmussen in a new documentary called Flea. It's a mix of animated reenactments and news footage over an interview between the two friends.
Hjem er noget, som er trygt.
Kabul, les attaques des mujahideen repris.
And joining us now is Jonas Poor Rasmussen. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much.
All right, so Amin Nawabi is not your friend's real name. You have given him a pseudonym, and the animation also disguises his true identity. And we find out why in the film he needs to maintain his secrecy. How did you negotiate that with your friend and convince him that he could safely come forward to tell his story?
I don't think I had to convince him per se. He kept this story a secret for years and years, and he really felt a need to get the story out there. But he was a little concerned about, you know, because what you see in the film, what you hear in the film is the very first time he shares the story. And he was concerned to be in the public eye with something that is very traumatic for him. You know, it's not easy for him to talk about these stories. So if all of a sudden the people in the street would notice things about him and would want to small talk about what he experienced, like he just didn't feel comfortable about that. So the fact that we could make him anonymous behind the animation was really kind of what enabled him to open up and start sharing his story.
And had you ever done animation before?
No, this was my very first animation. So it was, yeah, it was quite a steep learning curve.
Right. And so what can you do using animation that you can't do in the traditional way of producing a documentary, telling a story?
One thing was, you know, keeping him anonymous while still having a face there, which, like, you can't really do in live action. Flea is really a story about memory and trauma, and the animation enabled us to be a lot more expressive about these things. So whenever he starts to talk about something that's really hard for him to talk about, you could sense that all of a sudden the testimony became about, you know, emotions and not just about what things looked like or what happened, but about his inner emotions and his inner experiences. And with the animation, we could go a lot more surreal and expressive and dreamlike and be more honest to his emotions and his traumas than we could have done with a camera.
Hmm. Why did he want to now get his story out? What was the need to do that now after so many years?
You know, he felt this kind of disconnect between his past and his present all these years, that he couldn't really bring his past with him. But even more so, you know, when you keep a secret, you kind of distance you from everyone around you. And he really felt a need to, again, be able to connect his past and present and start talking about what happened to him and be honest in his close relations. So I think for him, it was really about finding a place where he could be who he is with his past and also with his sexuality, find a place where he could be who he is with everything that entails.
So he is not only a refugee who had a very difficult time getting to safety to Denmark, he's also gay and gender nonconforming when he was a child in Afghanistan, which was very difficult too. He had two secrets, I guess.
Yes, exactly. You know, Flea is kind of a double coming out story. When he was a kid in Afghanistan and he was gay but couldn't be openly so. And then when he arrived in Denmark, he couldn't bring his past with him. So all of his life, he's had to hide parts of himself. He's had to flee parts of himself. So, you know, the film is called Flee and is about the physical flight from Afghanistan to Denmark. But it's more so a story about a man who's had to hide parts of himself all of his life.
Well, let's talk about his early days in Kabul. What was it like for him as a child in Kabul? What was going on there?
You know, the very first interview I did with him, we kind of went back and asked him to talk about his first memories. And, you know, it was very loving memories, like being with his family, being with his siblings. And one of the first things he talked about was this Walkman his sister had given him. And I then asked him, like, what kind of music did you listen to in Kabul? Expecting that it would be some local Afghan music. But, you know, I was, to my surprise, he listened to the same, you know, Swedish pop songs I listened to back in Denmark. We start out in the film with Aha, Take On Me, instead of Afghan music. I got surprised by that and I thought, okay, but, and I really liked the idea that we kind of start out with a young Afghan boy listening to Aha in Kabul.
Yeah, because you can relate to him.
Exactly. It's really about creating relatability.
What did you see in him when you were on that bus? Like, why did you decide to become friends with him?
You know, I grew up in a very small village with like 300-400 people in it. So I think whoever kind of came into town, I was interested because I didn't have that many other boys my age in the town. But, you know, Amin really caught my eye because he was very fashionable. Like, he cared about fashion a lot, and his clothes were super fancy, and people around there didn't care that much about their clothes. So he caught my eye immediately, and I just thought, okay, but this guy looks cool, and I really wanted to get to know him. And then, you know, he learned Danish really fast, and we started meeting up at the bus stop every morning going to high school, and, you know, just conversation started flowing, and we became very good friends pretty fast.
So back in Afghanistan, he and his family initially had to leave. This was after the Soviets left in 1989, right? And the Mujahideen took over and their dad was arrested and imprisoned. And so he had to leave with his sisters, his mother, his older brother. How old was he at that time and where did they go?
He was 11 years old when they fled Afghanistan, and you know, the civil war had been going on for years, but not inside of Kabul where he lived. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Soviet withdrew their troops, like what just happened now with the American and Danish troops as well in Afghanistan. So they had to escape because the Mujahideen took over the city. So he was 11 and fled with his family, and the only place in the world that would give them a tourist visa was Russia. So they went to Moscow, where they stayed for a while, a long while actually, But Russia was a weird place at that time because it was just after the wall came down, and there was a lot of corruption, and you know they were in a bad position all of a sudden in Moscow, where the very cynical Russian police just pressured them for money and tried to take advantage of their situation.
And they were basically like prisoners almost in their apartment. They couldn't really go out because they would be harassed or beaten by the corrupt police.
Yes, exactly. So pretty fast, they tried to find a way out, you know, and they had that family in Sweden that helped them with money so they could hire human traffickers to try to see if they could get to Sweden as well. But, you know, being in the hands of cynical human traffickers going on this kind of journey, it was a very harrowing journey, and they had different failed attempts to go to Sweden.
Yeah, I think we have a clip of tape of where Amin talks about fleeing Moscow and remembering he wasn't dressed warmly enough.
Og så blev vi lige siddet af på et eller andet tidspunkt i en skov, og så skal vi sidde der og vente, og det er helt vildt koldt. Og vi har ikke sådan rigtig ordentligt tøj på.
And what is he saying there?
Yeah, he's saying that they're in this truck that normally carried wood, and they're driven into this forest, and it's really cold, and they're not wearing enough clothes, so they're freezing. And then they have to cross, you know, that they're crossing a border between Russia and Estonia, and then from Estonia they're trying to get on a ship to go to Sweden.
It really reminded me of, you know, people trying to flee the Holocaust, like running into the woods and being cold and having to march and march and march for hours, and you know, many dying along the route. I mean, did it evoke that for you?
My grandmother was born a refugee in, and she was actually born in Copenhagen, where I live now. But my great grandparents were Russian Jews and had to flee the pogroms and did the same journey across the Baltic Sea from Russia to Denmark. So yes, it's the same as the Holocaust, but I think it's a really universal refugee story, that you kind of are in the hands of people who you can't really trust, who just want your money. And then my grandmother, she was born in Copenhagen and seeked for asylum, but was in a limbo, and they got rejected, and then they had to move on to Germany. She had to stand up in class in Berlin with a yellow star on her chest, and then they had to flee again. So I think these kinds of stories are universal refugee stories and things that just happens over and over again.
But you didn't know that connection between yourself and Amin until years later, right? That you shared that similar story. I mean, not you personally, but your great-grandmother and Amin. The same journey.
Yeah, no, exactly. I of course knew that my grandmother was born a refugee, but I didn't really think about it. I feel very Danish, but in the process of making this film, you know, my perspective kind of changed, and I talked a lot to my mother about what happened to my own family. And also, you know, flee really came out of my own curiosity about my friend. It really came from the friendship, and I was curious about his story. I didn't think I wanted to do a refugee story and then went out and found a refugee. It was really because I was curious about his story. Mm-hmm. And then there was a big refugee crisis in Europe in 2015 because of all the Syrian refugees who came. And all of a sudden I felt the need to, you know, give a human face to the refugee story, because a lot of the time refugees are just described by what they need and not as the complex individuals we all are. And I thought, but maybe because this is a refugee story told from the inside of a friendship. And to me, you know, Amin, yes, he's a refugee, but he's so much more. And I'm hoping that I can give some nuance to the refugee story. And when Amin arrived in Denmark back in the 90s, you know, he was received and he was told that you're safe here and you can stay, you're allowed to stay. And that kind of allowed him to start building a life for himself. But now it's become different, you know. When refugees arrive today, they're told that, yes, they can stay, but as soon as we get the chance, we're going to send you back, which is not really something you can build a life on, you know? So people are just kind of stuck in a limbo for years where they don't know what their future is going to look like. I think 3 to me is really a story about trust and how trusting each other kind of creates value.
So what is it like now for Amin, now that he has told his story, he's unburdened himself? How is he now? How is he different? How does he feel about it now that his story is out for everyone to see?
He's in a good place. You know, we're in touch all the time. You know, when we started making the film, one of the first things he said was that he actually didn't care if the film was going to be made or not. For him, it was the act of sharing his story was really important to him, to get it out there and that, you know, take control and feel like he could start talking about it whenever he felt like it. Now he can, you know, now he can talk about it. And it really made him settle down. You know, he's with his husband and in their home. And he told me he really calmed down and he felt the need. He had to keep people at a distance all the time because he was afraid of getting exposed, that his secret would get exposed. But now he doesn't feel that fear anymore.
He's afraid because the smugglers told him not to tell the truth, right? So the smugglers told him to tell everyone that his family had been slaughtered, and that's why he showed up in Denmark alone, or his family had been killed. And that wasn't true. But why did the smugglers tell him to keep that a secret and to say that his family had been killed?
First of all, because they don't really know the law. Amin was given asylum when he arrived because he was a minor from a war-torn country, and not at all because of his background story. We got his file and had a lawyer look at it, and he could see immediately that he was given asylum because of his background story, but just because of his age and the fact that he came from Afghanistan. So it is because they don't know the law, but also, you know, they really want to cover up their own tracks. You know, they don't want to tell anyone their routes. So he had to say that he came third from Afghanistan and all by himself, so the police wouldn't be able to track them back and kind of stop their business.
So here he is. He is how old when he arrives in Denmark?
He was 16.
Doesn't speak Danish.
No.
Is all by himself. And he has to figure out this whole new way of life while keeping all of this stuff secret.
Exactly. When I learned that he was safe legally, I was really excited about it. But when I told Amin, you could just tell that he went back through all the years that he's had to keep this a secret, all the years where he was alone, and the fact that he couldn't be with his family because they officially didn't exist.
Did he ever reunite with his family, with his siblings, with his mother?
Yes, he did. His mother died like 10 years ago from natural reasons. They reunited before she died. And he sees his family often, you know, at special events, at weddings, birthdays, and special holidays. They're reunited.
And how do they feel about his sexuality?
They're fine about it. I think I had a prejudice against how they would react to it. And Amin did so as well. And you'll see that in the film, that he thought they wouldn't be able to accept it. But sometimes you get surprised in a positive way.
Exactly. It's a really remarkable film. So thank you so much. I urge everyone to go see it. And thanks for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That is writer and director Jonas Poor Rasmussen. And you can see Flea at the theater at the Landmark in West LA and the AMC Sunset 5. Coming up, what is going on with LeBron James and his on-again, off-again COVID status? We'll also talk football and baseball with the Sklar brothers next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
The sound of a cheering crowd tells it all.
LeBron James tested positive for COVID and the negative again, but still yet to miss a game. If you're confused and frustrated, so is he. USC has a new football coach from Oklahoma who could be the one to bring back the team's former glory. And Major League Baseball owners have locked out the players the first time in more than 25 years. Here to talk about it all are the Sklar brothers, Randy and Jason. Hi, you guys.
Hi, Madeline. How are you?
I am well. Well, let's begin with baseball. And the commissioner wrote an open letter to fans basically saying the league made its very best effort to reach a deal but could not, and they were forced into a lockout. So did they do their very best to reach an agreement?
Here's the thing that fans don't want: an open letter from the commissioner. It is just common knowledge that every fan base of every sport hates the commissioner. That's just it. Anytime Roger Goodell is at the draft of the NFL and he just stands up at the mic, he gets booed. Gary Bettman in the NHL, they hate him. So you're not going to win any points with the fans here with this.
And an open letter definitely is sidestepping the negotiations and trying to reshape the public image of what's going on. Because certainly in light of a pandemic, I don't think a lot of people who've lost income, lost pay, are going to be excited about a lockout where billionaires are trying to keep millionaires from working. In the end, keeping baseball games from happening, which is what the fans want. So Manfred trying to get out ahead of it with this open letter, saying that the owners have done everything under their power and the players just weren't listening to them. The one thing that is important to know is that this is taking place right now. The only thing that may be affected, hopefully, are the winter meetings. Spring training, pitchers and catchers reporting doesn't really happen until February. And I think the general consensus is that baseball will come to some agreements. Players may not get everything they want. Owners may not get everything they want. But really, this is an argument over how soon can players become free agents? Because a lot of times players come into the league right away, they get low salaries, and then they perform amazingly, but they can't get to free agency until a certain age, 28 years old, 27 years old. And so they're fighting to have that age lowered, and owners are fighting to keep it higher. It's about money, as it always is. And then there are other rule changes that may come into effect that will affect all of us, like maybe a 14-team playoff where the best records in each league draw a bye in the first round of the playoffs, and then division winners get to pick which wild card team they play. They're also talking about a clock on how fast pitchers can pitch, almost like a shot clock, but
to
pitching.
Speed up the game. So, and potential DH in the National League, a designated hitter, which is something that's never been done.
So a lot of changes could come out of this, and it could be a good thing, and hopefully it doesn't affect spring training and games.
Okay, so they have a couple of months to work out their differences and perhaps issue more public statements and letters to all of us.
Sure, open letters.
We like an open letter. All right, so let's move on to USC and football. There's a new head coach there. Lincoln Riley, who came from the Oklahoma Sooners. And he is a bit of a wunderkind, I guess, from all accounts.
Brilliant. Yeah, brilliant, brilliant offensive mind. Did wonders with Oklahoma. Under his tenure there, Oklahoma had Heisman Trophy winners at quarterback. They had very innovative offenses. He's not very defensive minded, which, you know, I don't know if it's going to hurt the USC in the Pac-12, which typically isn't the teams that have done well in the Pac-12 are teams like Oregon, which has a great offense, not such a great defense. And Oregon's coach Mario Cristobal just went back to his alma mater, Miami. So now there's a bit of a coaching vacuum in the Pac-12. USC, Lincoln Riley can definitely recruit. You know, USC is a wonderful place for kids to come. USC usually wins its recruiting battles with teams like Penn State or Michigan because kids want to come out to LA. Kids want to be out here in the sun. And so you have a lot to offer. And when you have a great coach, that just makes it even more enticing to be here.
And isn't it interesting that Lincoln Riley leaves Oklahoma when Oklahoma is about to join the SEC, which Oklahoma will be leaving the Big 12, where they've kind of enjoyed a dominance over the past several years, but Oklahoma and Texas, those two schools are moving to join the SEC.
Which includes schools like Alabama and LSU and Georgia. Alabama and Georgia are two of the four teams in the college football playoffs this year, along with, we should mention, University of Michigan, our alma mater.
Yeah. Are you excited?
Very so excited. I'm actually embarrassed at how happy it's made me that we made these playoffs. I'm like, I'm a grown person. I shouldn't be this happy about a game, but they are actually for the first time in the college football playoffs. I think it's good for college football that not the usual suspects aren't there. Cincinnati, which is a school that is not from a Power 5 conference like the Pac-12, like the Big 12, like the Big 10, like the SEC, they made it because they're undefeated. So it's a nice grouping of teams.
And
and you could tell that Lincoln Riley, maybe some of his decision to leave Oklahoma before it gets into the SEC and much stiffer competition, has decided to go out to USC to maybe help make USC one of those teams that squeaks into the playoffs every year out of the Pac-12.
Right. And but was it a little unconventional how USC scooped him from Oklahoma? Like, are they not supposed to do that, poach from another college like
that? Well, no, but it was a little rough for that school because, you know, Oklahoma still has a bowl game to play. And, you know, USC announced earlier this year that Clay Helton was fired. And so they were without a head coach, a top level head coach. They had an interim head coach. And, you know, they were searching and looking, but the deal is, unless they were going to get someone like Urban Meyer, who comes with a whole lot of other baggage, there weren't a lot of big prospects on the market. So this is the best they could have done. They grabbed a young, hot, like very good coach who has a lot of a strong future ahead of him, and they grabbed him at a point when they could get him.
At least USC and what happened to Oklahoma didn't happen to Notre Dame, which shortly after USC got Lincoln Riley, Brian Kelly, the coach of Notre Dame, bolted for LSU, which had a coaching opening there. LSU, a very strong program in the SEC, or has an opportunity. A few years ago, they won the national championship. He left Notre Dame, and he didn't tell any of his assistants or his players. Kind of left under the cover.
No open letter?
No open letter. Someone get Rob Manfred on an open letter for the
Okay, let's shift gears and talk about LeBron. He missed the game against the Sacramento Kings last week because he tested positive for COVID. And he talked about the experience Friday in his post-game interview.
And I had to figure out a way to get home from Sacramento, you know, by myself. They wouldn't allow anyone to travel with me. No security, no anything. You know, I had to put, you know, my kids in isolation for the time being and put the people in my household in isolation for the time being. So it was just a, you know, big time inconvenience. So
okay, so then he played against the Clippers Friday. So obviously he took another test. It came back negative. What's going on?
Took two tests. Had a false positive, and he took two tests. And you know, LeBron James, you kind of view LeBron James as someone who is very buttoned up on his health. And you know, it was funny earlier. He kind of did this thing where people look to LeBron James to say everybody should get vaccinated, and he kind of deflected it and said, it's your choice. And they asked him, are you vaccinated? He said, that's my choice. And so I think, you know, he when it came back as a positive test, it just drummed up all of that other controversy for him. It's controversy he didn't want. And he's had some weird moments in the last few weeks. He, you know, was suspended for a game, first time in his career after basically swinging an elbow and an arm and punching a Detroit Pistons player and bloodying up his eye, which is just very uncharacteristic of LeBron. He grabbed his crotch as a gesture at a fan and was
fined
for that. So, I mean, you kind of are in this moment, those things built together along with this positive test. You're like, what is going on with LeBron? But he had two negative PCR tests after the fact, and you know, big deal. You had to fly home from Sacramento by yourself. You mean like everybody else who has to fly home from Sacramento? That's the worst thing that's happened to you, Bron? Come on.
I think a lot of us would like to be on a plane by ourselves.
Right.
I mean,
geez. To put your kids on another plane, if you're a parent of small children, you said that sounds like paradise. That's wonderful. You take care of them.
Okay, so the Chargers star player Keenan Allen tested positive for COVID. We have just a few seconds, but what does this mean for the Chargers playoffs?
The Chargers are actually a really good team, and they have a great quarterback. Keenan Allen has been the guy that Justin Herbert has, the safety valve, the guy he goes to all the time, has made a lot of tough catches. So it may affect them a little bit. They're in second place. The Rams are in second place, so they're 8-4.
Rams have a big game on Monday night against the Cardinals, who are in first place. There's a lot of great stuff to watch if you're
an LA sports fan. There are a lot of teams to root for, and you've got a lot to look forward to.
Okay. That's a great positive way to end the segment and end the show. Jason and Randy Sklar, known as the Sklar Brothers, and check out their sports podcast. It's called View from the Cheap Seats. Thanks, you guys.
It's not false positive. It's regular positive.
Thanks.
Oh, my gosh. They are funny, those two. All right. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand, and I will be with you again tomorrow.